In the Lyric feature this week, Alois Fleischmann, The Freedom of the City, the second of two programmes about this important Irish composer, conductor, teacher and musicologist who lived from 1910 to 1992. Contributors include his daughter Ruth Fleischmann, Seamus de Barra, Micheál O'Sullivan, Kitty Buckley, Professor John A. Murphy and Patrick Zook. We hear the composer himself from RTE archive recordings.
Well, I suppose I'm a mongrel, if you like, with too many things, trying too much. I would be happiest as a composer if I could feel that I really had something worthwhile to say. But otherwise, I think I'm happiest to be just a jack-of-all-trades.
We used to take it for granted that Dad was always working. We didn't even begin to think just how extraordinary his achievement was, work-wise, until we started actually looking at what he left behind us to sort out. And my nephew, his Irish grandson, has made digital photographs of 15,000 letters of his. And these were selected by my sisters Maeve and Anne so that they would take out the most important ones. And it was only then we realised just how much writing he did.
I'm Kitty Buckley. I'm a music librarian in Cork City Library. This exhibition is called Fleischmann Family and Friends. There are 16 panels. It's roughly divided into three sections, the from Dachau and the parents, where it all began. There's Fleischmann, the child and family man, and the third section is the public man. So this is the family tree then. Well, this is the Alois, who was a shoemaker in Dachau. So this is Fleischmann Senior, then he was their only child. And then this is Tilly here and her father, Hans Conrad Schwartz, who came from Prussia originally and was in the North Cathedral. So in any case, Tilly and Alois came to Cork. And after much to do in 1910, Tilly went on a recital tour of Munich, and believe it or not, while she was there, young Alois, or Professor Fleischmann, as he later became known, was born. And he wasn't very pleased to be born in Munich because he identified very strongly with Ireland and would much prefer to have been born in Ireland, but that was how it worked out.
Well, I always assumed I was going to become a musician because my mother, being a pianist and teacher, was involved in music all day. My father had his choir at the cathedral and also ran a choir in the town, so that music was going all day, year in, year out, in my family. I did spend a lot of time playing the piano and latterly the organ, but I never had the facility of being a really good pianist. I just had enough technique, I suppose, to illustrate lectures. That's about all.
His father wanted him to become a church musician, of course, follow his on his own footsteps. He was a brilliant scholar, of course, need I add. And, of course, he came first in Ireland in four subjects. And he was very proud, you know, of his achievements. Then he went to UCC. From that, then, he went to Munich on his father's advice to study. And he spent 2 years there, but instead of becoming a church musician like his father wanted, he decided he wanted to go the road of composition.
Originally, his style in the 30s would have been a very personal idiom, which was diatonic dissonance, I suppose, with the best, with a certain amount of chromatics colouring it, which gave it a colour and a harmonic pungency and so on. It had to be that, really, to accommodate the folk song influence. not that he really quoted folk songs as such. This was a much more subtle thing than actually quoting a folk tune. It was more to do with the general curve of the melody, an atmosphere, if you like, that he felt he could distill into his music. But you needed essentially a style which was fundamentally diatonic in order to do this.
Seamus was known as James Barry, just as John Reedy became Sean O'Reilly later on. James was a student of my father's, I think one of his last ones. And we knew that my father was very appreciative of his talent as a composer. We commissioned him a few times for work for the Cork Festival and also, I think, for the Cork Symphony Orchestra, if I'm not mistaken.
By the 1960s, this style began to change, and the obvious diatonic contours that may have arisen from folk music began to be less evident in the music. Became more dissonant, more angular to a certain extent, with a degree of bitonalism, polytonality, and so on. Even at that stage, however, he would have been far removed from his more experimental contemporaries on the continent. And with the more extreme experiments of contemporary music, he was never that much in sympathy.
It was, I think, a great conflict of interest for him. But of course, if you have set up something like the Choral Festival, you just have to get it done. You have to make quite sure that the daily organisation is done. And it was, I suppose, there were 3 months of the year when there was a slight lull, but it was certainly a 9-month constant effort. Then he had the Orchestral Society, which organised concerts in Cork. He had his orchestra, which performed at least about 3 times a year. He had his teaching, he had the exams, and countless other committees that he was on, all of which required preparation and research very often so that he could make his case for the various causes he had espoused.
So that's the rectory now where the music department in UCC was for so many years. It's now in St. Vincent's Church, but for the bulk of the time, like when I would have been there now, It had a collegiate feel because you could go in there and practice and study on Sundays even, you know. It was open all weekend. So it was like one big family. I would have been there now in the late 70s and there would have been kind of 45 in the whole department between the 3 years. So everybody looked out for everyone else, you know. And, I mean, you got to know everyone. So, you know, it wasn't anonymous like the other parts of college could be, you know.
I then graduated in 73 and went teaching for 2 years in the second level system. And then I came back and I got a job as a junior lecturer or an assistant lecturer. So I was back working with him within 2 years. And I was Mr. O'Sullivan. And he used to pull his face like that, you know. Yes, Mr. O'Sullivan. He was really, really wonderful man. And then at a certain point, there was also Geoffrey Spratt also came in as a year after me. I'm sure Geoffrey will remember this as well. At one of the staff meetings, there was just a slight embarrassed silence of something was going to be said. And he said, "Now, we should be on first name terms. You can call me Alice." And from after that, I was Micheál and Geoffrey was Geoffrey and he was Alice. And I was very uncomfortable with it for a while until, in fact, I was always uncomfortable with it in a way, you know, because he was so engagingly anachronistic. He was a 19th century figure in the 20th century. I don't mean that as a negative thing, but he had a kind of received formality.
So this is a bust of Fleischmann done by Marshall Hudson. And here beside him is his pal, Sean O'Reilly, who lectured with him in the music department in UCC. he saw to it that Sean O'Riordan got a job, you know, as a struggling composer. And he was a great inspiration to him as well. I think he was the one who inspired him to, you know, do classical music, basically.
After I left, I went the O'Riordan route. Then I went into a stage where I suddenly wanted to start scoring. I wanted to work with professional classical musicians. 1988, 89, the Irish Chamber Orchestra. I started to go that direction and, of course, mixing traditional musicians with them. But in order to work with professional classical musicians, I suddenly realised, well, I can't go in and hum them the tune. You know, these guys don't operate like that. So I have to score large parts of what I want. I turned around, and even though I hadn't done it for 10, 12, 13 years, I had all of the tools. Fleischmann had given me all of the tools to a very high degree, including mental imaging. Yeah, I suddenly realised, yeah, I can sit down with a score in a library without any instrument. I can hear the music. Because that's how he trained me, you know. And so, you know, when I write the dot on the page, I hear it. You know, I don't have perfect pitch or anything like that. I write a chord, I can hear the chord. I can hear the colour in the orchestration because he taught me this. I didn't get it from anywhere else. He taught me slowly and consistently, and I mean consistently. The consistency was astonishing. I was now 25 and I got that position. I think one of the reasons I got the position, I'm pretty sure actually, is that Fleischmann would have known that as well as giving the traditional music lectures, because now I was becoming known even in the national media and radio and television as somebody who was into trad, investigating trad, talking about it. So, but he also knew that he could call on me to do keyboard harmony with the students, to do musicianship with the students, a lot of those kind of extras that music students at that time needed to do. And indeed, that was true. So when I went in, you know, let's say I was doing, say, 14 hours a week or something, and maybe 12 of those might be in non-Irish traditional music elements. And piece by piece, I increased that until the traditional music elements and ethnomusicology were 100% of what I was doing. And I'm walking all the time between orality and literacy. And for orality, read O'Riordan. For literacy, read Fleischmann. So for me, the Fleischmann-O'Riordan dichotomy is deeply resonant with the literate-orality dichotomy within me. And I still don't want to get away from that. This is a lifelong challenge and problem to engage with.
But there were other characters too, like Den Donovan now. He was known kind of like the Delphic Oracle. He used to be the commentator for years and his voice was so distinctive. You know, every time I see him, I think of the Choral Festival. You know, there are people that you identified with certain things.
Don Donovan Gringas and so on is. Olof Lekiola, Glas Corky, Agus, yes, Freshman, then I never all far on doing. Because the song, you see, of course, professor music says, regrettably, he says, I don't sing, you know. And Cluder says, oh, I'll talk him out. He says, oh, I said, I'll fiddle in on some egg, Mike, or something. He said, to ring a ring, you know. So Priceman said, you know, certainly I'm not with him on the violin behind. And then he said, Oh, that's a busking son, make busking son, to doing dress, dress, and a musker. And Fleischmann said, I'm sorry, he says, I don't play the box either, the musical box. And Kruger was heard to say, in an end day, he says, can't so deal all of the Keole shoots, not pay the lish, or on. Now on fiddle hind, now on busker pure hind. So Fleischmann told that himself, you know, he told it himself as a kind of a an instance of the sort of the nature of an academic musician, really, you know, who kind of would be a little bit divorced from the, might say, the more popular performance culture that we've done.
Fleischmann would never be seen, you know, he'd never be downtown having a pint at a session. I mean, that was not the scene, you know, with him. That would just not be on. So he never really... he never really engaged in the live engagement with the music. He was always a step back from it because it was a different social world. He was from a generation and a culture which had a high art, folk art, pop art hierarchical view, which was the opposite to mine. I mean, I would respect anybody with that point of view, but I would always go out of my way to point out that I believe they were wrong. But it came from a different era.
We thought we'd take his campaign to get a professional group of musicians in Cork, an RTE performing group. And he campaigned from the early 50s until 1959 to get a string orchestra based in Cork. He didn't get that, but he did get a string quartet. And that was the result of a huge campaign of endless writing to the various departments, to RTE, making the case, getting support for it, researching what the situation was in other countries, how they supported music in the regions. And finally, RTE had to give in, and the quartet arrived.
Subterranean sound produced by gentlemen who have the habit of singing in their boots. I wonder, for those of you now who are down an octave below us, come right up. It'll come out in the air, you know. We're on the air, by the way. Hope you realize that. Another thing you're inclined to drag. I want you to sing as a choir, not as a congregation.
I remember listening to the Song of the Provinces, which was performed in Dublin, and being entertained by the way he did it. I had wondered, how could you ever teach an audience to sing when you've got a professional choir on stage and in the National Symphony Orchestra? I thought, my God, that's not going to work out. We had never, of course, experienced Dad as a teacher, because he took no interest in us. In fact, he would leave the room if we were practicing when he came in. He would usually wince and go off. I think we always felt a certain amount of tension listening, hoping that it would be okay, but not being quite sure that it would. And we were very relieved and very entertained to hear him do such an entertaining show for them, and very pleased at the very warm reactions from the audience.
Fleischmann felt that the festival should really have a creative dimension as well, and not just be choirs singing rounds of competitive pieces, and that it should have a dimension which was more in contact with current developments and what composers were actually doing. So from the very beginning, an Irish composer was commissioned each year, and obviously he set himself to commission established figures first, even though his colleague in UCC, Sean O'Riordan, was amongst the first group to be commissioned in 1962, along with Mio, interestingly. Kodály had been asked to write a piece, but was too ill to come to Cork at the time.
And then Dad had the idea of creating a seminar which would commission works, new works of choral music, to be performed at the festival and analysed, first of all, in the presence of the composer, sung by a choir of his choice, and first performed in the university. So you had another link between town and gown, and apparently many of these composers were rather surprised at what was discovered in the music that they hadn't noticed themselves. There was also a question of educating the audience, because the music was very modern and they weren't used to that at all. The committee very often felt that the music was far too avant-garde and it wasn't a good idea to inflict it on the audiences. My father refused to compromise there, and in fact for 2 years there was no seminar. It was stopped by the committee, but was revived again and worked out extremely well. And I think they commissioned during his years about 80 new choral works, which have been performed since all over the world, with the little tag commissioned by the International Choral Festival in Cork.
Professor Boydell from our sister university, if so youthful an institution as ours may call so venerable institution sister, but we're delighted to have him with us. Professor Boydell has taken all sorts of vowel and consonantal sounds, and he's experimented in a most interesting way with these. I suppose the term mouth music is a direct translation from the Irish portbail, lilting music without text. I think I'm right in saying that it's used traditionally to accompany dancing when there's no instrumental accompaniment available. But such use of wordless song or lilting is not really confined to Ireland, it's worldwide. I heard only the other day of a singer from Vietnam who did the most extraordinarily interesting and virtuosic things with this kind of mouth music. Apparently wrote the thick lips being an asset in this form of vocalizing, which Europeans normally lack. Well, now he uses a special notation for certain types of tone, and we'll comment on this as we go along. But first of all, if I may, as usual, just give you a piano reduction of the first movement.
Fleischmann would first of all present an analysis of the work at the piano, illustrating from the piano, discussing the work, as he said, as a theory. In other words, how it left the composer's desk, the concepts of the work, how it actually fitted together, what the structural principles were, what the composer had done, the kind of things he had attempted to do in the piece, and his handling of the words that he had chosen to set, and so on.
Similarly, eating fillet of mutton with rottenly corked goose. You could hardly get a greater antithesis than this romantic chord and the word which the composer has very naughtily introduced. Well, there's your French sixth. Now he's got "Oh, Mister," but quite with a great deal of pathos.
And then when the score had been analysed in this manner, there was a performance of the piece, so that the members of the seminar could hear how the theory, which had now been elucidated, worked in practice. Fleischmann was very skillful in presenting these analyses. He did it with great good humour, I have to say. He had an excellent manner of presentation. He was always meticulously prepared, of course. There were a couple of his scores still extant with his minute markings and commentary that he would read out during the analysis thing. And he would draw parallels with other works. He would draw parallels between the poem. He would make suggestions. He would ask the composer to elucidate points and so on. And then once that was finished and the performance had taken place, it was thrown open to the floor.
Mr. Hackle, 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 Mr. Hackle,
Occasionally you might have a waspish or bad-tempered comment. Fleischmann would usually have gallons of oil to pour on troubled waters should this actually occur and smooth things over as best he could. Even though I have to say, when we were students, he used to egg us on privately to actually create a controversy. But he would never say anything that would be in any way discourteous to a composer. And he did get some, shall we say, variable works from the seminar from year to year. He was never at a loss as to what to say about them, but he would never ever betray to the composer that he thought the work was poor or in any way unsatisfactory.
Well, I've had a whole team at work on it. We call it Sources of Irish Traditional Music, and the idea was to incorporate all the Irish collections and as many tunes in Scots and Welsh and English collections as are relevant to the Irish tradition. It all arose because when I was appointed at UCC first, I used to get queries from all over the place asking me questions about Irish folk songs, questions that nobody at that time could answer. Occasionally it's possible to get somebody like Donal O'Sullivan to answer the queries, but I felt that the only thing to do was to assemble all the existing records in one large volume and then to have cross-references showing how tunes vary from one period to the next, analysing them structurally and with regard to tonality, and have indexes so that one can actually locate a tune just by... If one knows its first 12 notes, then it's possible to have a thematic index, and that means that you can trace any tune that you need, either by its title or by its incipit, by its first 12 notes.
What he tried to do was to put them all together in one volume, because there are various collections, but they have never been assimilated, and he had to, of course, trace them. Went to Scotland, all over England, London, and the various collections in Ireland, and made sure that they were all available in one very large collection, as you see. It was funded by UCC, he got funding from UNESCO and from a whole pile of other sources, had many assistants who helped him, because, of course, no one person could do that. And it was finally then, due to Mihalis Ulevoin's help after his death, it was finally published in New York in 1998, I think, and launched in UCC by President McAleese.
And of course, I was working with him on this ginormous Sources of Irish Traditional Music project. They had started, he worked on it for the last 40 years of his life. The largest research project undertaken up to this time in Irish traditional music, published in two volumes after his death by Garland Press in New York and London. An investigation of 7,000 tunes from the 16th century up until the mid-19th century in prints and in manuscripts scattered throughout England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland. And I even as a student, an MA student, I was helping with this. And I think, again, that helped me to get the position. So once I got in, I kept helping with that until eventually, maybe 2 hours every Wednesday, about 4 o'clock, I put it in my timetable. I would spend with him, assisting him. O'Rear, they used to assist him with it. Pilla Bolera was an also part-time teacher there, used to assist him with it. And I then spent from 1970, actually when I was doing my MA, 73, up until his death. And I was always scared that this was going to happen, and it did happen. He died before its absolute completion. Now, it was almost completed, so I inherited the task, of actually bringing it to press, which took me 6 years, and assembling a postgraduate band around me. And I actually brought the whole thing here to the University of Limerick when I came here in 1994, and we ended up publishing it in 1998.
I think it would be lovely if there was an electronic version of it, a digital version, perhaps in a DVD, or as you say, on the more modern technology, so that people could access it without carrying these two heavy volumes around with them. Maybe someday, who knows?
Extremely important, and the degree of its importance has not yet been recognised. And the reason it hasn't been recognised is because the publishers, Garland, have failed to... They're an academic house. So what they do is you give them the whole thing in camera-ready copy. They probably print anything between 300 and 600. And then they sell them off to university libraries who are into Irish studies and things like that. They know their market. And they know they can get, say, $300 to $400 to $500 dollars or whatever per set. And they have it all worked out. So they keep their costs up. So, but your ordinary guy in the street never gets to see it. You'll never see it in Hughes's bookshop or in Eason's. And, you know, so they're very difficult to get. And I've kept saying to the people in Garland, bring out soft-bound copies for about 150 and you'll sell them at the Willie Clancy Week, like hotcakes, to traditional musicians. Because there's 7,000 trad tunes in here and about 5,500 of them aren't played in the tradition anymore. So it's just an example of a failed opportunity. I am trying to assist the Fleischmann family in revisiting that the sources, possibly seeing whether they can be lifted into electronic format and also seeing whether we can get, shall we say, a popular, more attainable, better available version of a hard copy published as well. But this was massive.
Graduates really are all over the country in different professions. I mean, I'm sure he never realised that he was training a music librarian when I was there, you know. When he needed stuff, he would come in, you know. So he was very supportive of the music library as well, and he was really funny because he was notorious for damaging records, you know. He'd put the needle on and it would go scraping across the thing, and when he'd come in he called everybody Miss, you know. Everybody was treated with impartially, so Miss, I was Miss Buckley always, and he'd say, Miss Buckley, if I've done any damage now, I'll be sure and tell me and I'll pay for them. But he was so honest about it that you couldn't charge him. But he gave the music library great support. Then we were threatened with closure in 1987 when the recession hit. In those days, cultural institutions were the first to go, you know, so such a basic service now. But in 1987 we were threatened with closure, so Professor Fleischmann got on his motorbike and he was negotiating between the city manager and the city librarian to have the decision reversed. And so our existence today, we could nearly say, is due to the work done by Professor Fleischmann and Joan Denise Moriarty as well. She intervened as well on our behalf. So they had great belief in everything, you know, and ironically at the time I think the Cork Ballet Company folded. So even though Joan Denise saved us, she couldn't save herself.
He was always in very good health, in fact, until about, I suppose, about a year before he died. He did an 8-hour day. He had a little office in the Maltings up on the top floor, and he was working on his huge project on Irish folk music, which he worked on until 3 days before he died. And he had a huge correspondence, as we now see. He had various causes which he was still involved in very much, but most of his work, I think, was research and checking for this project, Sources of Irish Traditional Music.
My name is Patrick Zook, and I teach in the music department at the University of Durham in England. I first met Alois Fleischmann when I was in my early teens. It would have been perhaps 1981, 1982 perhaps. I was 13 or 14 at the time. So we used to meet every Wednesday afternoon for, well, the marathon lessons that used to last between 2 and 3 hours. A lot of analysis of scores. So, you know, he would bring in scores of various works, some from the standard repertoire, anything from the late 18th century up to, you know, early 20th century works. And I'd be expected to go in and listen to these in the interim and, you know, look at their structure, and we'd be in a position to talk about them when we came back. So the format of the lessons used to be flexible. On another week, he might give me something to orchestrate. On other occasions, then, he might actually give me a particular piece to analyse. Well, it was a sort of technical training that I dare say would be very unfashionable. Lots of third level institutions, harmony and counterpoint isn't even taught, which is a great pity. I think his attitude would have been very similar to that of Schoenberg, that any young composer should have as thorough a technical grounding as possible, should be thoroughly conversant with the styles of the past, you know, have a good knowledge of the musical repertoire. His tastes, by and large, were drawn towards the Austro-German canon. So obviously Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, you know, 19th century German and Austrian romantics. Then, of 20th century composers, certainly he had a very considerable interest in contemporary German music, modern German music before the Second World War. He certainly very interested in people like Hindemith, for example. He had a lot of interest in French composers. I think his tastes were quite broad in those respects. And while he certainly wasn't uninterested in the expressive possibilities of, say, compositional procedures like serialism, for example, I think he was suspicious of what he felt was their excessively cerebral nature, and was inclined to think that they hampered a composer's spontaneity.
Point in the Suburbs, a setting by Professor Fleischmann, are words by one of our finest contemporary poets, Thomas Kinsey.
You certainly find the later scores from Cornucopia of 1969 onwards, through pieces like Tides, Poet in the Suburbs, and so on, that these works they're more dissonant, they're more angular, more aggressive, if you like, more elusive in some ways in terms of their mood, darker certainly. They don't carry the same conviction as some of the earlier works. That's a personal reaction of my own. Perhaps other people have found them to be excellent pieces. And his craftsmanship, of course, is always excellent. That's never in doubt. He never writes an incoherent piece. The last piece he wrote was Games, which was commissioned when he was 80 in 1990. And that year's choral festival saw the first performance of Games and the first performance of Clonmacnoise, and he didn't write any further music after that. I think it was a race against time to get the index finished, or the sources finished.
Well, I think they are completely underestimated and undervalued, and it's a scandal that there isn't a box set of all of Fleischmann's works up there. Now, I'm not making him out to be, twice as good as Mozart or anything like that, and he would hate me to do that. But here is very, very fine music, always, always, without exception, every note uniquely crafted. And even on that level of craft, this music should be available. But beyond that, there is inspiration. As he moved through his life, he started off with a kind of some Celtic twilight neo-modality, using the pseudonym, by the way, Muirish Ó-Ronan for a while, the Irish name. And then his music tightened a little. But what fascinates me was that it's only when he reached 60, there is a change which comes into the music, comes into the compositions of his final years. The music becomes very young. The music begins to move towards a post-modernity at that point. It begins to lose, it loses its utopian feel, and it takes on a kind of sonic reality. And that's where his craft stood so well to him, because it really suited things like Poet in the Suburbs, people that later on, Games, that's another piece. It was like a completely different composer. I'm not saying the early works aren't of interest, all of them. You can't understand the late works without hearing the early works. So I would say, and particularly his final compositions, and if he'd lived another 15 years, he would have been composed. He would have got better and better and better and better as he got older. I've no doubt about it.
And the other event involved him personally was, of course, the famous Ascent of Mount Brandon in 1990. It was his 80th birthday. The story was, in the family, I'm not sure if it's true, that old Herr Fleischmann had attempted this feat on his 70th birthday, but had not completed it. Is that my recollection? And that your father decided to do it properly, as it were, in 1990.
He was diagnosed with cancer. I remember I came home in February 92, and he told me, which was very unusual for him, that he'd been to the doctor. And the doctor, to his surprise, he said, had said it was nothing, just a small bit of arthritis. But in fact, it was cancer of the bone. And that then, I think, became much more serious. In May, he had a kidney removed, I think. And I think then he realised that there was probably no future. So he did his very best to get the sources finished. He was doing proofreading and trying to write the introduction. I was home for the last week of his life, and I remember being very awed at seeing him sit at the table so frail he could hardly get up. And indeed, very often he couldn't push the huge heavy volumes that he had to check. So we would discreetly shove them over and make it look as if we weren't doing anything at all.
Well, together with his daughter Ruth, we are planning a volume which is essentially a selection of his letters. It will be, I think the title of the volume will be something like A Life in Letters. One of our principal problems is selecting suitable letters from the vast quantity of correspondence that survives.
And I think it was 3 days before he died, I typed a letter which was written to three nuns who'd sent him flowers and mass cards. Not mass cards, but sent him their prayers, I think. And I typed it, and he then had it read out, and I had to redo it because he had put the names of the nuns in the wrong order. That wouldn't do. So I tore it off, and he started afresh. And did it. So until the very end, he was most meticulous and had this extraordinary courtesy of if anybody wrote you, you just responded instantly. And I realise now in my attempts to organise the centenary celebrations just what a rare gift that is, that very often you can be writing endlessly to people and you just don't get the courtesy of an answer at all.
The former director of the Cork International Choral Festival, Professor Alois Fleischmann, has died. He was well known in musical circles throughout Ireland and was a former professor of music at University College Cork. He was in his early 80s and was a native of Cork City, having settled in the Glen in Cork.
Well, this is obviously a silver baton. We have that on the collage as well over that was presented at the Cork International Choral Festival, Silver Jubilee in 1978. This is a little bit by Seamus de Barra, one of his greatest pupils. This is sources then of Irish traditional music. So I think there's 6,670 tunes in all. This is his work then on the state of music in Ireland, and that's just a Capuchin annual on Hardebeck.
When my father died, James and Patrick Zook appeared on the doorstep and offered their help, because they knew that there was a whole houseful of scores in music and that none of us were competent to look after it. So they came up every day for I think at least a month, if not longer, and sorted out the scores, the parts, put them all in piles so that we would know what was what. And then we had the great advantage that Virginia Tian, who was at that time the archivist in UCC, she appeared one day and asked if we would possibly consider donating our father's papers to UCC. So between the two of them, James and Patrick, making sure that my father's musical legacy and my grandfather's were properly looked after, and Virginia's willingness to take everything we had, it meant we knew that everything would be in safe hands and that gradually it could then be classified and used for research and for writing.
We're hosting the website for the Fleischmann Centenary at the City Library. So the Fleischmanns gave us all the manuscripts and we've digitised all of those now, and gradually we're putting them up on the system. We have the scores online section now of Fleischmann stuff, copyright free, performance free, available to anyone who wants to copy them or, you know, extract parts from them for orchestra or whatever, you know. So that's a very useful thing.
And he felt himself that he was very much part of this effort which his friend and teacher Daniel Corkery had been involved in. And I think he was trying to do for music what the literary people had done for Irish literature, making sure that the links with the old heritage were preserved and that you then moved on, and that there was a fusion of continental, modern, contemporary developments, but built on the old heritage and not divorced from it.
The contribution he made also to traditional music research with the sources of Irish music. I mean, there's the three things: traditional music research, music education at all levels, and music composition itself, not to mention the organisation of orchestras, the organisations of choirs, the organisations of festivals, all his life festivals, organisations like Cogal na Siúint an na Gór, the organisation of Irish choirs, and the huge work ethic that he brought to everything that he turned his hand to.
After he died, I planned to do a study of his work. I always felt he was perhaps somewhat neglected. And so when Patrick Zook and I approached Seamus Dean a field day with our idea about producing this series of books on Irish composers, the Field Day Music Series, I was determined that the first volume in the series would be on Fleischmann.
His father came in 1906, his grandfather came in 1879, so I think that's quite a respectable squatter's rights, if you like, to Cork citizenship. However, had he been born in Cork, he couldn't have been given the freedom of the city, and that, I think, was one of the honours which he appreciated most. He felt he didn't deserve it because he couldn't have done what he did do without the support of so many hundreds of people. but he felt that he was perhaps accepting the honour on their behalf, and he was very pleased indeed that he was made a freeman of the city.
It's very interesting to note that when asked what his favourite work was of all his own works, he unhesitatingly said that it was Clare's Dragoons. I think he realised that in Clare's Dragoons he had struck a note which was authentic and could never be repeated in any piece that could be composed by an Irish composer. And fortunately, he brought off the task brilliantly, and the piece remains, I think, one of the classics of mid-20th century Irish music.
Bursting chart of Clare's Dragoons.
part of Clare's Dragoons by Alois Fleischmann, played by the RTE National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Robert Houlihan. That's taken from a CD release on the RTE Lyric FM label. Contributors to the programme included Alois and Ruth Fleischmann, Seamus DeBarra, Micheál O'Sullivan, Kitty Buckley, Professor John A. Murphy, Dan O'Donovan and Patrick Zook. The producer is Celia Donoghue.